Monitor Monday is recorded before a live online audience. From the studios of Brack Monitor, this is Monitor Monday for October 9th, 2023. Here's today's rundown. October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Brack Monitor investigative reporter Edward M. Roche reports on his recent visit to the laboratories of Memorial Sloan Kettering and one of the most exciting scientific developments of the decade. Also today, we'll hear from healthcare attorney Nicole Emanuel, Adam Brenman, healthcare attorney David Glaser, and Dr. Ronald Hirsch. Now here's the publisher of Brack Monitor and the host of Monitor Monday, Chuck Buck.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Monitor Monday. We have a great deal of news report, and so we begin this morning, as we usually do, with Dr. Ronald Hirsch. He's making his Monday rounds here on Monitor Monday.
Monday Rounds is sponsored by R1 Physician Advisory Solutions. Here now making his Monday rounds is Dr. Ronald Hirsch.
Well, good morning, all. Have any of you heard from us about the CMS rule requiring Medicare Advantage plans to follow the two-midnight rule in 2024? Well, if you're tired of it, too bad. I've got more to say. Actually, the rule has more to say, and I wanted to make sure people are aware of some of the other provisions. First, it bears repeating that the use of commercial criteria by MA plans is not prohibited. The plans are more than welcome to use MCG criteria for inpatient to approve an inpatient admission. Heck, they can use their magic eight ball to approve admissions. But when it comes to denying an admission or other care, then using criteria as the final arbiter is not allowed. And as I've said before, I like criteria. Yes, I know every patient is different and no criteria set can encompass every possible patient-disease interaction. But common things happen commonly, and criteria do an excellent job there. The other thing is that criteria can do well is to consolidate the medical literature. The standard of care should be judged on what is optimally done for a condition, not what is done at one facility. Dr. Bill Rifkin of MCG has written extensively about the variation, and it is surprisingly amazing how prevalent it is. Sorry about my computer beeping in the background. I recently saw data from a hospital where 100% of their Medicare total knee arthroplasties were done as inpatient. It turns out that their physician's standard practice was to keep all patients at least 3 days. Now, technically, under the two-midnight rule, that means they can admit the patient as inpatient based on a more than two-midnight expectation. But is that appropriate? As a review of the medical literature, or MCG would tell you, the standard of care is same day or next day discharge. A payer could then use this criteria to determine that this hospital's physician is not practicing per the prevailing standard of care. Again, they can't deny inpatient admission based on that criteria, but the payer and the hospital know which cases need secondary review. The same can be applied to patients with heart failure or pneumonia. It needs to be established which patients require hospital care and for how long, and which patients need that second midnight in the hospital. It's not what the doctors at St. Elsewhere do. It's really about what the standard of care is. And be sure criteria is used properly. Right? On day two, a patient who passes only observation criteria or fails discharge screening needs ongoing hospital care, and that means inpatient admission, not extending observation past the second midnight. Now, what if criteria aren't met? Well, again, CMS makes it clear that such tools alone cannot be used to deny care. If it's going to be denied, it has to be reviewed by a physician or other healthcare professional. But more importantly, in this new rule, CMS requires that that person has expertise in the field of medicine or healthcare that is appropriate for the service at issue. That means a pediatrician is welcome to approve an inpatient admission, but they cannot deny one for an adult unless they've cared for hospitalized adults. An internist who's never cared for patients at an IRF cannot deny an IRF admission. So starting in January, if you get a denial, feel free to ask for the person's qualifications. And if they refuse, well, then it's time to start causing some trouble. Chuck, back to you.
Thank you, Dr. Hirsch. That was the Vice President of R1 RCM, Ronald Hirsch, MD. Dr. Hirsch was making his Monday rounds here on Monitor Monday.
Here now with the Monitor Monday RAC Report is healthcare attorney Nicole Emanuel. And good morning, Nicole.
Good morning and happy RAC Monitor Monday. CMS released the final rule on risk adjustment data validation, or RADV, audits of Medicare Advantage organizations, or MAOs, January 30th, 2023. The RADV program is CMS's mechanism for validating the accuracy of diagnoses submitted by the MAOs for risk adjustment. Arguably, the MAOs receive higher reimbursement rates for more severe diagnoses. The goal of RADV audits is to identify and correct any discrepancies or inaccuracies in the diagnoses reported by the MAOs. Inaccurate coding can result in overpayments or underpayments. Now, a quick summary of the 2023 rule. CMS, number one, CMS will extrapolate. This final rule allows CMS to audit a sample of MAO diagnoses reported for RAD for risk adjustment purposes, and then use the audit findings to calculate an extrapolated improper payment amount for the MAOs. This extrapolation technique is controversial for a number of reasons, including whether CMS has the authority to use it in the manner proposed in the final rule and whether it is actuarially sound method of auditing. Now, number two, CMS will not apply a fee-for-service adjuster in RADV audits to account for any effect of the erroneous diagnosis codes in the data from Medicare Parts A and B that are used to collaborate the MAO risk adjustment model. And third, MAOs will be required to remit improper payments identified during RADV audits in a manner specified by CMS. Well, September 1st, 2023, Humana filed a lawsuit against United States Department of Health and Human Services, and the plaintiffs allege that the Medicare Advantage program is based on a foundational bargain that is being threatened by the final rule. Now, this bargain is that the MAOs agree to provide their enrolled Medicare beneficiaries at least the same level of benefits that the beneficiaries would receive under traditional fee-for-service Medicare. And in turn, CMS agrees to pay the MAOs the same amount that CMS would expect to cover those beneficiaries if they remained in fee-for-service. Now, this bargain is codified in the regulation 42 U.S.C. 1395W-23A1C1. Quote, to ensure actuarial equivalence. According to the complaint, however, this final rule breaks this bargain and undermines the financial stability of the Medicare Advantage program. At the heart of the plaintiff's complaint, they're just saying this doesn't work. The complaint gave a very simplified example in the complaint, and I'm going to use this example here. So if CMS were to divide 1,000 of total spending associated with epilepsy among 100 beneficiaries whose doctors report an epilepsy diagnosis code in fee-for-service Medicare claims data, it would calculate an average incremental cost of $10 per beneficiary with a reported epilepsy code. But if the agency instead audited those claims forms against the underlying medical records for those beneficiaries and found that 50 of the diagnosis codes were not documented in the medical records, it would divide the $1,000 in spending associated with epilepsy across only the remaining 50 diagnosis codes for an average expected incremental cost of $20 per day per beneficiary with a documented diagnosis code. In other words, according to the plaintiffs, there is a greater number of Medicare beneficiaries who are reported to have a given condition that is documented or have a condition in using one standard for risk adjustment payments and another for RADV audits, and they're saying it's not actually sound. We shall see. To be determined. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Nicole. That was healthcare attorney Nicole Emanuel. Nicole is a partner in the law firm of Nelson Mullins. And coming up in about 10 minutes after the hour in your time zone, you're going to hear from healthcare attorney David Glazer, Adam Brenman, and Rack Monitor investigative reporter Ed Roach, who's standing by in New York to report our lead story. It's Indigenous People Day. It's Monday, October the 9th, and you're listening to the live edition of Monitor Monday. Stand by.
Here's a special offer you won't find anywhere else, an offer you can't refuse. Purchase the Cardiac Rhythm Management Coder and receive the free webcast titled Implantable Medical Device Credit Reporting for 2023, What You Need to Know. These companion webcasts will help you gain insights that could save your facility hundreds of thousands of dollars in repayments and fines by mastering CMS requirements for implantable medical device credit reporting. Don't miss out on this limited-time offer to revolutionize your coding process and acquire expert knowledge. Purchase the Cardiac Rhythm Management Coder and receive the free webcast titled Implantable Medical Device Credit Reporting for 2023, What You Need to Know. To take advantage of this offer, enter discount code FR012523 at checkout before October 27th, 2023.
Here now with the Monitor Monday Risk Business Report is healthcare attorney David Glazer. And David, as I say every Monday about the same time, what could be risky today?
Well, Chuck, it's the risk that you're going to rely on a basic and logical understanding of the English language, and as a result, fail to comply with the price transparency regulations. Now, if you work for a hospital, please listen closely to what I'm about to say. If you're outside of a hospital, the price transparency rules don't apply to you, and you can skip my segment. So I've been working with hospitals that are trying to comply with a state law that requires hospitals to charge uninsured patients the lowest rate the hospital receives from any contracted insurer. And I'm hearing a steady stream of complaints from hospitals in that state saying that having this data is impossible. Now, I can't comment on the logistics, but I know this. Federal law requires hospitals to be making that data available. It's part of the price transparency regulations, which appear at 45 CFR Part 180, and that were published in 2019. So the regulation requires hospitals to make a machine-readable file that includes all of their standard charges for items and services available to the public. That makes the definition of standard charge absolutely essential. Alas, the definition is incredibly confusing, if not affirmatively misleading. Because it uses standard charge, singular, one might assume we're talking about a single price. That assumption would be absolutely understandable and yet completely wrong. 45 CFR section 180.20 defines standard charge as the regular rate established by the hospital for an item or service provided to a specific group of patients. Now, once again, the use of the singular suggests a sole price, but the text continues. This includes all of the following as defined in this section. 1, gross charge. 2, payer-specific negotiated charge. 3, the identified minimum negotiated charge. I'm sorry, that's the de-identified maximum negotiated charge, and the discounted cash price. Now, there's a lot going on here, and I will acknowledge it's confusing. But it means that the hospital has to have, for each item or service, a file that lists the highest and lowest reimbursements received for that code. In a really incomprehensible twist, the highest and lowest reimbursements can be de-identified. The reason that's so confusing is that you must also list every single charge that's been negotiated by the third-party payer, and that list has to name the third-party payer. You've got to specify what you get from Blue Cross, Aetna, UnitedHealthcare, and everyone else. So you de-identify the highest and lowest and then list them all. This makes no sense. The fact that so many hospitals said they don't know the lowest reimbursements they received as part of their negotiated contracts suggests to me that they're out of compliance with the price transparency rule. Now, this rule's got some teeth, Remember, originally it was just a $300 a day fine, but now hospitals with 550 beds can be fined up to $5,500 a day for non-compliance. So if you're in a hospital, check with your CFO and make sure you're making available a machine-readable file that includes the five items that I listed above. Chuck, I'm going to end with a confusing song reference that befits the confusing rule. Now, I like a lot of REM songs, but much like the price transparency rule, their lyrics are really difficult to figure out. One of their queries, "What's the frequency, Kenneth?" is a reference to a line uttered by a man who attacked Dan Rather back in 1986. Like the rule, it's a puzzle. But even if, like REM, you're saying, I never understood, I recommend you put some effort into determining a way to comply with the rule. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, David. That was healthcare attorney David Glazer, David Sherwood, the law firm of Fredrickson and Byron in downtown Minneapolis. Up next, Adam Brenman with the Monitor Monday Legislative Update.
The Legislative Update is sponsored by Zealous. Zealous is modernizing the healthcare financial experience by bridging the gaps and aligning interests across payers, providers, and healthcare consumers.
Here now is Adam Brenman.
Thanks, Chuck. Good morning, everyone. Back in April, I was on the broadcast discussing the end of the government's declared COVID-19 public health emergency, which ended in May, and along with it, the start of one of the largest program rollbacks, that of the Medicaid continuous coverage requirement. This pandemic-era requirement directed states to keep Medicaid beneficiaries enrolled regardless of changes to their eligibility in exchange for a boost in federal funding. When the requirement expired, states were able to resume income eligibility checks or redeterminations for the first time since 2020. Since then, states have been terminating Medicaid coverage for millions of people who remained covered under the Medicaid program during the pandemic. So I thought I would check in on how this has been unfolding over the last 5 or so months. CMS initially estimated that over 15 million of 92 million Medicaid enrollees would lose coverage throughout the redetermination process. That's 16% of total Medicaid beneficiaries. Additionally, of the 15 million, 7 million were expected to remain eligible for the program, but still lose their coverage because of administrative or bureaucratic hurdles, like missed or poorly written notices or incorrect paperwork. As of late September, a total of 7.5 million people nationwide had been disenrolled from their Medicaid coverage as a result of state redeterminations. Another of CMS's estimates was that one-third of the 15 million enrollees expected to lose Medicaid coverage as eligibility checks resumed would qualify for ACA coverage. Unfortunately, the Washington Post reported last week that as Medicaid rolls are being cut, few are finding refuge in ACA plans. Until now, federal officials have refused to release data showing how many people leaving Medicaid have an ACA plan. But once they do, the initial figures are expected to significantly lag. The government requires Medicaid agencies to electronically transfer to marketplaces the cases of consumers who appear eligible for ACA coverage. But some cases are transferred with outdated addresses or phone numbers, making it difficult for the exchanges to reach people who might benefit. Further, according to HHS, the government has been actively collaborating with states to make sure Medicaid beneficiaries don't lose coverage because of administrative issues. Alas, states continue to face challenges with Medicaid redeterminations all the same. CMS believes that Medicaid eligibility systems in a number of states are programmed incorrectly and are conducting automatic renewals at the family level and not the individual level, even though individuals in a family may have different eligibility requirements to qualify for Medicaid. Correspondingly, HHS announced in a September press release that 30 states have reported such problems. HHS has since noted that the agency will work continuously with states for as long as needed to help prevent anyone eligible for Medicaid coverage from being disenrolled. Although identifying this lingering issue, which has been leading to many coverage losses, is seen as a step in the right direction, coverage losses continue more quickly than anticipated. On the bright side, HHS just announced that the agency has helped 500,000 children and adults get their Medicaid coverage restored, while ACA exchange directors have pointed out that marketplace health plans could become more popular over time. However, millions of Medicaid beneficiaries are still without health insurance, and thousands more have the potential to still lose coverage via the ongoing redetermination process. So it doesn't seem like nearly enough is being done on a larger scale. Now, there are clearly important lessons to be learned from the fallout thus far of the Medicaid continuous coverage requirement and its impact on continuity of care. Perhaps there will be a rosier outlook if we check back in another 5 months. Back to you, Chuck.
That was Adam Brennan. Adam is a federal legislative analyst for Zealous.
With the 2024 proposed rules having an impact on inpatient and outpatient admissions, ASC procedures, and Medicare Part C and D, one thing is clear. The various aspects of the Two-Midnight Rule are firmly in place for short-stay admissions. And now the Two-Midnight Rule extends to Medicare Advantage patients. Join Michael G. Callahan for a comprehensive webcast covering federal laws for all admission processes. Gain the knowledge needed to navigate audits effectively and optimize patient access points, personnel, and compliance strategies. Learn Two-Midnight Rule essentials, Medicare Advantage implications, and compliance best practices. Discover operational insights for short-stay admissions, outpatient observation, and the ever-changing inpatient-only list. The webcast, Mastering the Two-Midnight Rule, Keys to Navigating Short-Stay Admissions with Confidence, is now available on demand at the RAC University Bookstore.
RAC Modern investigative reporter Edward M. Roach files a story on his recent visit to the laboratories, Memorial Sloan Kettering. And Ed, you say that what you saw there was one of the most exciting scientific breakthroughs in a decade. That's a huge statement.
Yeah, it is. It's not often that you get such good remission rates. So I was in the laboratory at Memorial Sloan Kettering staring into a microscope at living cancer cells. The group of researchers had recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine. They had tested a large number of cancer patients, a special molecular biological compound engineered to interfere with the growth of colon cancers. Rate of remission, 100%, unheard of. The tumors had simply stopped growing, decreased in size, then disappeared. Let's look back. The earliest description of breast cancer is from Egypt, 1500 BC. The oldest treatment for cancer is surgery, still widely practiced today. Unpleasant effects. One needs only mention the word mastectomy. Metastasis guarantees the cancer comes back and eventually overwhelms the patient. In 1895, Roentgen discovered X-rays. Radium gamma rays became a source of cancer treatment. Healthy tissue would be burned. By the 1970s, radio-oncology, however, was accepted as standard clinical practice. Tough on the body. Hard to recover from sitting in front of a cyclotron 5 times per week for 2 to 3 months. Bones become fragile. The skin turns to leather. Not effective. Until the 1960s, combination radiation and surgery cure rates remained stuck at around 33%. It was discovered that soldiers after the end of the First World War exposed to mustard gas had depleted bone marrow and lymph nodes. Mice with lymphoid tumors exposed to nitrogen mustard improved. A human test on non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 1943 saw a marked improvement. The United States later launched the war on cancer. So many compounds to evaluate. The testing area at the National Institutes of Health was nicknamed the Puke Ward. It took a long time to find the right compounds, the right dosages, the right protocol and timing. Chemotherapy was highly controversial. Researchers at scientific conferences would face an audience standing up and screaming, "You are administering poison to your patients. You're killing them. This is madness." Newly graduated doctors were told not to go into chemotherapy because it, quote, would be a career killer, unquote. Chemotherapy now, however, is the mainstay of much treatment. Insurance can be a barrier. Surgery and recovery is expensive. Chemo without insurance can be around $50,000 for four sessions. Insurance denials are commonplace, not medically necessary. Medicare Advantage plans appear to deny claims by default. All but a quarter of denied claims for cancer are reversed when appealed, a 75% error rate. For these compounds engineered at the molecular biological level, will the well-heeled insurance establishment pay its bills? My guess, it all depends on cost. I was speaking with the lead researcher at Memorial Sloan Kettering, a surgeon. Why would you be interested in this type of treatment? Won't it make the type of work you do obsolete? He smiled and answered, "No, it is the other way around. Imagine cancer treatment without surgery and without radiation. The patients will be lined up at the door." Well, perhaps the insurance companies will be happy to pay because the ultimate cost for cancer treatment will greatly diminish. No surgery, no radiation. In medicine, science is what is important. All else is secondary. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Ed, very much. That was Rock Monitor investigative reporter Edward M. Roach. Mr. Roach was reporting from New York City. And folks, that's going to be a wrap for this live edition of Monitor Monday. We thank you so very much for being with us today. And a special thanks to our panels this morning, Adam Bredman, Nicole Emanuel, David Glazer, Dr. Ronald Hirsch, and Rock Monitor investigative reporter Ed Roach, who reported our lead story. And one more thing before we go, folks, be sure to listen to me tomorrow on Talk to Enthusiasts. We're going to be talking about the IHEMA National Convention. It's taking place right now in Baltimore. Until then, everybody, goodbye and have a great week.
Monitor Monday is a presentation of Rack Monitor.